welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and our show today is going to be very special. For people who haven't heard, there's the prisoners in the Pelican Bay SHU have launched an indefinite hunger strike around demands, basically demands that come down to demanding that they be treated like humans, saying they're humans, and they demand to be treated as such. Basically, we're going to have the vast majority of the show is going to be dedicated to that. In the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Clyde Young, revolutionary communist and former prisoner, who will share his experiences in prison, talk about the hunger strike, and why it's important that people support it. Before that, we'll be talking with Marilyn McMahon, who's the executive director and treasurer of California Prison Focus, on the hunger strike itself and the demands, the background, and what's going on with the whole thing. Before that, we'll be talking with Laura Magnani. We had Laura on the show back on New Year's Eve in 2010, talking about what are the conditions, what is life like for the prisoners in these SHU units, in particular in Pelican Bay SHU. And for those who aren't familiar with the terms, SHU is the acronym for Security Housing Unit. Now, these security housing units are in a number of prisons in California, and they're part of a whole network of supermax prisons across the country. The hunger strike we're talking about that began on July 1st at Pelican Bay SHU is way up at the northern border of California, so it's part of the California state prison system. But opening up the show, I thought it was very important to have on this guest talking about Afghanistan. What's the significance of the latest developments that the U.S. Imperials have put into motion in relation to Afghanistan? And that is Larry Everest. Larry is a frequent guest on the show. He's a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
You too. Good to have you here, man. Well, let's jump into this because we're on a tight schedule. This has got to run like a well-oiled machine, which, frankly, no creaking allowed. All right. Let's talk about this. Basically, you made the point many times in your writings that what the U.S. was doing in Afghanistan and in the situation in the Middle East and in the world in general has never been mainly, not only and not mainly, about hunting down the people responsible for 9/11, nor was it about liberating people in the countries the U.S. attacked. But from the very beginning, it was aimed at addressing major strategic challenges that the U.S. Imperials were facing in the Middle East and Central Asia. And when Obama gave his speech, you also argued that this speech and what they're doing now in Afghanistan is rooted in the same basic drive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, basically the impetus for the whole global so-called war on terror was really a broad range of strategic challenges and opportunities that the U.S. imperialists faced dating back to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Just to focus in on Central Asia, where Afghanistan is and where this war began. Afghanistan abuts two of the main potential rivals the U.S. faces in the world, Russia and China. It's the energy together with the Middle East. It's the energy heart of the world, oil and natural gas. And it's also a center of Islamic fundamentalism, which had become a challenge to U.S. power in the region, U.S. control of this region. Some people have called this the geopolitical heart of the world. So launching this war, this so-called war on terror, was an effort to defeat these challenges, radically reshape the planet, and strengthen U.S. domination of this region, all as part of creating an unchallenged and an unchallengeable empire. Now, defeating Islamic fundamentalism and showing that the U.S. could lash out at those who had reportedly launched the 9/11 attacks, this was part of this agenda, but it was part of it in the overall context that I'm talking about. Simply finding Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden or whomever was never the focus. This is why the U.S. was not focused on that when it initially invaded Afghanistan. It didn't refuse to talk about to the Taliban about possibly turning bin Laden over. This is why the U.S. has been fighting in Afghanistan, even though in the last several years there's supposedly very few foreign jihadists there. But the big contradiction has been, because this has been a war of empire, not a war of liberation, it's been deeply, deeply against the interests of the people. Look at the reactionary butchers that they've installed in power in both Baghdad and Kabul, in Iraq and Afghanistan. this war has been carried out by enormous terror. Two Afghan children are killed in the war every day in 2010. WikiLeaks revealed something like 24,000 were killed in Afghanistan between 2004 and 2009. And then there's a new report that 250,000 Afghans have been terrorized and driven from their homes by U.S. night raids and drone attacks and so on in the last 2 years. So all of this has created enormous hatred, opposition, unfortunately driven people, many people, toward either tolerating or supporting this reactionary Islamic fundamentalist, and created a whole host of contradictions and problems for the imperialists. And this is what Obama sought to address.
Well, let's talk about how he sought to address that, because it's very heavy. I mean, this is, you know, how does this move to reduce the number of troops in Afghanistan, you know, 10,000 now and eventually 33,000 people altogether, 33,000 troops being removed. I mean, it's one thing, it's got to be put in the context of how many troops are actually there. But then, two, how is this drawdown in any way related to this strategy that they're pursuing?
Well, essentially, I think what they're trying to do is hold things together in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but really in a certain way reorient and regroup to be able to deal with even bigger challenges around the world. One thing we have to be clear on is that, you know, Obama basically claimed mission accomplished, light at the end of the tunnel, thanks to the surge that he had instituted, tripling the number of troops beginning in 2009. And if you count the contractors in NATO, we're talking about 250,000 troops there. But the core of the surge has been escalating violence and training, unleashing more night attacks, drone strikes, local warlords and militias who've terrorize the population, beating, robbing, killing with impunity. So rather than creating a more stable situation, you have a government that's in Kabul more hated than ever. The Taliban is still able to strike anywhere in the country. It controls much of the eastern mountains next to Pakistan. And so Obama was and the U.S. ruling class were really faced with this vexing choice that what they had done wasn't really fundamentally changing the situation on the ground. So they were faced with a choice of either cut their losses or double down in hopes of victory. Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, wrote he thought the options in Afghanistan were lose early, lose late, lose big, or lose small. He votes for lose early and small. So this is the situation that Obama was trying to deal with, and which has given rise to a lot of very sharp debate and struggle in the ruling class.
Let me remind listeners, we're talking with Larry Evers, journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about Obama's recent decision regarding the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan and what it means strategically for the U.S. Now, Larry, one of the things that you've been saying all along has been that these kinds of contradictions that you're raising that are faced, a lot of this is very sharp stuff. I mean, there's been all kinds of things in the press about how Obama had to go against many of his military commanders to actually do this. And this stuff has raised contradictions not only in relation to, it's not only speaking to contradictions raised in Afghanistan, but it also is generating even more contradictions, you know, among a lot of Obama's top advisors, including his military generals, and I think it, again, this is rooted in something that you've mentioned to me when in previous conversations. You mentioned a quote from the defense secretary, Leon Panetta, who said that this is a time of historic change. We're no longer in a Cold War. This is more like the Blizzard War, a blizzard of challenges that drew speed and intensity from terrorism, from rapidly developing technologies, and a rising number of powers on the world stage. That's a pretty heavy statement in terms of the description of this. What do you make of the significance of that?
Well, I think it's very reflective of this very rapidly changing global situation and the profound multi-layered contradictions that are gripping this empire. I mean, there isn't, just keep in mind, there's no historic permanence to the U.S. empire. It is not written in stone. I mean, Panetta in his testimony talked about the upheaval across the Middle East, the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. There's very great concern in the ruling class about the rise of China and the development of its military and influence in East Asia. All of this is taking place during the midst of the greatest financial crisis in 80 years. I mean, it was interesting. Gates, in his farewell tour, one of the things he said was, in all his time in government going back decades, he had never been in a situation in which the U.S. was forced to even consider cost in meeting so-called national security needs. In other words, in meeting the military demands of empire and global dominance. So this reflects I've read another report that the wars have actually cost something along the lines of between $2 and $4 trillion, not the $1 trillion Obama mentioned. So these are very, very deep problems. And the problem the U.S. is facing is if they leave 100,000 troops in Afghanistan or escalate further, it risks the situation getting even more fraught, even more unstable, and inflicting a major defeat on the United States, which has tremendous repercussions. It isn't simply whatever happens to the U.S. military. It's also about how the whole world perceives U.S. power and its ability to really shape events. We also could be looking at the collapse of the government in Afghanistan, great unrest spreading into Pakistan, which is a country of 160 million people with nuclear weapons. There's a very, could this trigger a war between India and Pakistan with unthinkable consequences? All of this really, really is in play. And apparently, let's not forget, now Obama is still leaving twice as many troops, 68,000 troops in Afghanistan, at least for the next couple of years, than were there under Bush. But the trajectory seems to be to try to shrink down their objectives, hold on, but really reorient it to these other global challenges that they're facing very acutely across the Middle East, but also in the world as a whole. And again, the point of this, coming back to where we began, the point of this is to try to defend and strengthen and maintain a predatory system of global exploitation based on the kind of enormous violence we've seen the U.S. unleash in now Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan.
That's a perfect space, a perfect place to wrap this up, Larry Everest. I think I really want to thank you for joining us today. And we'll have you back to dig deeper into this because I know we're kind of rushed today given the situation at Pelican Bay and the fact that we want to concentrate a lot of the show on bringing that out to people. So thank you very much,
man. Michael. Hey, listen, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Larry, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Larry Everest, the journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the Obama's drawdown in Afghanistan and how it's rooted in the strategic questions for the U.S. imperialists, not in some kind of we held the fire to his feet and made him do something, or yes, there's a lot of people against the war, but they're principally acting from what are the strategic implications for them and what are their strategic needs. All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with Laura Magnani from the American Friends Service Committee about the conditions at the Pelican Bay Shoe.
'Cause if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land. and they will too. We all come to understand none of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us are chained. None of us are free.
All right, that's Solomon Burke. None of us are free. Joining us now is Laura Magnani, Interim Regional Director of American Friends Service Committee, Pacific Mountain Region, and the author of Buried Alive, Long-Term Isolation in California's Youth and Adult Prisons. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back. You know, we had you on New Year's Eve, actually, it was, on 2010. Very dedicated. But and I got so many just requests around that interview and so many people thinking that what we talked about at that time was very, very important. And in light of the strike that's happening at Pelican Bay right now, the indefinite hunger strike by the prisoners in the Pelican Bay SHU, I thought it'd be very important to have you back to give people a sense of what Pelican Bay SHU is. So can you start off by giving them a sense of that?
Sure. Pelican Bay, first of all, is a prison that's way, way, way up north, just about to the Oregon border. So it's about as remote a location as you can get in California. And the security housing unit, the SHU, is a special unit made up of basically boxes, windowless boxes, 8 by 10, where people are housed really permanently, in many cases, in a solitary confinement situation, total sensory deprivation, very limited opportunity to have any connection to other human beings, and very, very limited visiting privileges of any kind.
That's amazing. How many people are in the Pelican Bay SHU?
In the Pelican Bay SHU, there are about 12,000. It's hard, 1,200, excuse me. It's hard to get these numbers because they're not, you know, made public, but that's our best estimate. And in California, in general, there's over 3,500 people in security housing units.
Wow. Now, you know, you've made the point that this is basically, well, let me ask you this first. What's the difference between being in a SHU in Pelican Bay, Corcoran, anywhere, and doing punitive time in solitary or being placed in administrative segregation?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's hard to answer because each prison actually has a lot of autonomy about how it, you know, what kind of privileges or lack thereof that it provides in given situations. The biggest difference between ADSEG or administrative segregation and the SHU is that ADSEG usually is for a limited amount of time. Now, these times can be ridiculously long, like over a year, but it's not a permanent assignment. And it's fairly frequent in ADSEG that you actually have a cellmate. You're not there entirely on your own. And in some cases, I think that's also true in SHU units, although I don't think it's true at Pelican Bay.
Well, let me ask you this. How do people end up in there? Because I know there's a whole big thing, including in the demands of the prisoners, about basically people are funneled in there for various reasons. And it's not the same as being put in there for punishment, which you get when you're doing time in the hole, for instance, classically. You know, but the SHU unit is actually much more directed towards or coming from a certain end or a certain drive.
Right. Well, what we're told officially by the Department of Corrections is that that these units, of course, are reserved for the, quote, worst of the worst, and that there are five things that can get you there: attacking a guard, attacking another prisoner, weapons violations, drug sales, or validation as a gang member. Our experience is that the fifth one of those, the gang member situation, is really what gets you there, because all those other things are, you know, things that they would send you for disciplinary infraction. So those would really be people who would end up primarily in ADSEG. Whereas it's the gang affiliation or being a political prisoner or perceived as an agitator of some kind that will get you there for these permanent conditions.
Which actually says something about what they have to do, what they are trying to do in the SHU to these prisoners, because you then have people who are sentenced there, who are placed there for an indefinite period of time, could be for 20, 30 years. You have people who are there for their beliefs.
Well, that's right, and I think it's important to also talk about what gang validation, quote unquote, is, because it's a very sophisticated form of racial profiling. People are don't have to have committed any gang related act of any kind. It's just some form of association. You know, somebody says they're part of the gang. They receive a letter or a communication from somebody in a gang. It's the loosest kind of standard of association. And, of course, you know, guilt by association is unconstitutional. But it's really what goes on when we're talking about gang affiliation. And then the issue becomes, how do you unaffiliate? How do you prove that you really don't have any affiliation. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. The standard procedure takes about 6 years of zero contact with any gang member. And, you know, none of us has control over our contacts. You know, anybody can send you a letter. Anybody can try to contact you. And once that happens, you're considered, once again, affiliated, and the 6 years starts all over again.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you is that one prisoner described the SHU, the security housing unit, as having made a science out of isolation. And prisoners themselves, including in the call for this hunger strike, talked about the prisoners facing physical and psychological torture. Can you give people a sense of the daily life for a prisoner in a SHU?
Well, I think there's no question that it is psychological torture because of the level of isolation. I mean, if you have such limited access to any kind of stimulation, intellectual or human, it works on your mind. I don't know about you, but I think for me, it probably lasts about a day and a half. There is an actual recognized mental health condition called the SHU syndrome, which comes about from this kind of solitary confinement. And what happens is that people get agitated, they start having hallucinations, they get into confused psychotic states, and this is all well-documented material from the kind of litigation that's gone on about these units over the years.
One of the things that they've also brought up, I mean, it's very heavy to me in terms of, you know, they talk about the things that, when I talked about the science out of isolation, it's very conscious. All these things that are done, I mean, the whole construction of the thing where it's windowless, as you've mentioned, and it's, you know, you can't really see out. If you see much, all you're looking at is through a slot. You have very little human communication. You know, they also have something that they developed called the short corridor, which kept appearing in all the calls for this hunger strike. And I was curious about that. What is the short corridor? What does it mean, and how did it develop?
I don't actually know very much about the short corridor. We also have seen it, you know, regularly show up in our correspondence. And I'm not sure that conditions in the short corridor are different from the SHU conditions in general, or if it's just a geographical space within the prison. It may be that one of your other guests knows more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know is that by keeping people sensorily so deprived, like you say, not being able to see more than that. The other thing that's used frequently are two other factors. One is sound. Sometimes they're just constant din in these places because people are literally going crazy. So they may be screaming. They may be shouting out of anger. So the noise level can be deafening, or the noise level can be utter silence, which is also, you know, very disturbing to the human psyche. So there's the sound factor, and there's also the light factor. And again, these differ in different particular units, but sometimes the lights never go off. So when somebody is actually released from one of these units, they completely freak out by the fact that there's night and day in the world, and all of a sudden it could be dark. In other cases, people are held in darkness. And so using light, using sound, you know, using the lack of sensory stimulation, all of these things contribute to the SHU syndrome.
We're talking with Laura Magnani from the American Friends Service Committee and the author of Buried Alive. Laura, you know, let's talk about this psychological torture, this point about you mentioned about the SHU syndrome. But there's also the psychological torture, and then we can get into a little bit in the physical torture, because you've also mentioned the cell extractions as a very big part of daily existence in the life of somebody in a SHU.
Right. Well, if they decide that they're going to come after you for some reason, like they're going to do a shakedown of your cell. Now, don't ask me how anybody could get anything into their cell in these conditions. So it does appear to me to be just a harassment technique. So that you'll get like something like six guards in full riot gear descending upon you with their batons drawn and often putting you into 4-point restraints. And, you know, it's a very violent, very invasive tactic, which has, as far as I can tell, minimal, if any, correctional purpose or legitimate purpose in terms of keeping order in a prison, because you're talking, like I say, about a situation where, you know, somebody couldn't have received a weapon or something like that because they're in total isolation. So these things, you know, are very scary and work on people's minds and further contribute to this SHU syndrome. I think the other thing we have to say very as directly as we can is that these kinds of conditions do qualify as torture by any standard, any international standard we've ever seen. you know, because you can't hold people in indefinite solitude and not have it be an actual torturous situation.
One more question, Laura, and that is, you know, the last time we spoke, we had a discussion at the end of the interview about what's actually going on here and what's happening to these prisoners and how it really is a dehumanizing and a robbing them of their humanity and presenting that to people at large as these are people that deserve to be robbed of their humanity. And you mentioned then that what one of the big things about torture is, and I think about this in relation to, you know, a life without meaning in a lot of sense. When people are stuffed into a place like that, you can very quickly, if you don't have something bigger going on in your head, it's very quickly to lose all meaning in life, you know, and that's why I think the suicide rates are so high in these various shoes and whatnot in these supermax prisons. And you talked about robbing prisoners of an intellectual life as a big, big and important thing for people to think about in terms of the consequences of that. And I read in some of the material around the strike that one prisoner was even sent to a shoe in California for having reading materials about George Jackson. And it really struck me about this question of robbing people of an intellectual life and how important that is. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's one of the lifelines that we all have is our ability to use our minds and to stretch our minds and to make ourselves available for new thoughts and new ideas. And if you deprive people, and again, these are total constitutional violations, deprive people of thought, you know, deprive them of access to different thought and different ways of thinking, it really becomes another torturous situation where people don't have a way out. They don't even have a way out in their head if they're not given access to any kind of thinking or any way of dialoguing with intellectuals in the country. And I think the other thing I want to say about that is that we also have to look at the effect of these kinds of conditions on ourselves. You know, if we can legitimize the treatment thousands of people living under these kinds of conditions, if we can justify that, you know, then we ourselves are all less human for it and really worse for it. Because once you start to open that door, it becomes a bottomless pit, and they can call it the worst of the worst, but we know that the people that are being housed in these facilities have a broad range of possible offenses or no offenses at all. I mean, usually, you know, their offense has to do with either association or their political beliefs, and it's the politics. You know, we're supposed to be a country that is a democracy that believes in free thinking. And this is the absolute opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. All right, Laura, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for your show.
Sure, and we'll have you back again soon, so take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Laura Magnani, who's the interim regional director of the American Friends Service Committee, the Pacific Mountain Region, and the author of Buried Alive, Long-Term Isolation in California's Youth and Adult Prisons. And we've been talking about the Pelican Bay shoe hunger strike. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with Marilyn McMahon, the executive director and treasurer of California Prison Focus.
What a waste of human power, what a waste of human life. Shoot the prisoners in the towers, 43 tall windowed wide. Attica State, Attica State, we're all made with Attica State. Media
Alright, welcome back. Attica State from John Lennon. I just thought that was very appropriate for our discussion today And as we go into this, we're going to be talking in a minute with Marilyn McMahon, the executive director and treasurer of California Prison Focus. And we're going to be talking about how the strike came about, who's involved in it, the demands, things like that. But I wanted to read something from one of the prisoners. And I thought this is a great bridge between our discussion with Laura Magnani and the discussion we're about to have with Marilyn. And it says, it's from a prisoner in the Corcoran SHU, the Corcoran State Prison SHU. And he wrote about the involvement of the Corcoran prisoners in basically supporting this. And he says, our indefinite isolation here is both inhumane and illegal. And the proponents of the prison industrial complex are hoping that their campaign to dehumanize us has succeeded to the degree that you don't care and will allow the torture to continue in your name. It is our belief that they have woefully underestimated the decency, principles, and humanity of the people. Join us in opposing this injustice without end. Thank you for your time and support. You know, it's a whole different view of humanity between what the prisons, what the prison keepers, the prison wardens, what the state, what the system wants you to think about prisoners and what the prisoners themselves are thinking about. And as Laura was pointing to, how do we approach the prisoners? And I thought this was a very moving and heartfelt statement for people to consider and chew on. Right now, we're going to join Marilyn McMahon. Marilyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this. This is a strike that was called by the prisoners in the security housing unit at Pelican Bay Prison. It began July 1st to protest the cruel and inhumane conditions of their imprisonment. How did the strike come about?
Well, I guess you have to start, in some cases, decades ago when many of these prisoners were first put in the SHU. They've endured terrible conditions for that long. They've tried every means at their disposal to improve them. They've filed thousands upon thousands of administrative complaints. We know that routinely the guards disappear those. If they do work their way up the ladder, they're just denied, no matter how valid they may be in the vast majority of cases. They've tried the courts, and they filed many lawsuits and won very little, and even when they do get victories, the prison manages to just tweak the rules a little bit to conform with the court orders, but allow things substantively really to be the same. So these prisoners feel like it's their last resort. They have no other means at their disposal than starving themselves to death to bring attention to their conditions and get something to really change.
And that really is what they've been saying. And, you know, the idea that this is an indefinite strike, they're actually saying, and they have said in different things, that they don't want to die, but they're actually willing to take it that far because of the importance of it, huh?
That's right. They've said to me they expect and are prepared to endure months of force feeding, which, from what I hear, is an extremely painful procedure. But they believe the state will resort to force feeding them rather than letting them die. But they also have said that it's very possible that some prisoners are going to die in this ordeal. And they're prepared for it. I think you were just talking about what gives a life meaning and what can give meaning to these prisoners' lives. I think they've seized upon this hunger strike idea because they are thinking of other people. They're not only thinking of their own existence and how horrendous it is in the SHU, but that every prisoner in the system in California potentially can end up in the SHU, because tomorrow somebody can say that guy is a gang member. It can happen to anyone. It happens falsely all the time. And then they can end up in the SHU. So the ones organizing the hunger strike are doing it for everybody, and they say that. This is for the youngsters coming into the system, so they don't have to go through what we've gone through. I think it's a last-ditch attempt to make their lives mean something.
Well, you know,
and it is a very heroic thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that actually is very interesting, too, in terms of how this came about. Well, first off, do you know how many prisoners are actually involved in the hunger strike at Pelican Bay?
You know, it's hard to get really good numbers, partly because the prisoners can't communicate among themselves very well. So we hear different numbers from different prisoners and at different times, and I'm sure it's changing day by day. And, of course, people may pledge to it and then find they can't do it. And others hadn't known about it, and we'll find out, and we'll join in. So it's going to be very dynamic. We heard estimates of a few dozen, 50 or 60, as many as 100. I think what I heard most solidly, but this was a couple months ago, was maybe 50 or 60 starting today, but within a few weeks, maybe 100. But that was before prisoners at Corcoran found out about it, and the Corcoran SHU said that they're joining in solidarity. And we know that word is spreading at other prisons. So there's certainly a potential for this to snowball and there to be many, many more involved.
Let's go through some of the demands that they have. I think these are very interesting in terms of giving people a sense of what's going on and why these prisoners would be willing to stand up and launch a hunger strike, an indefinite hunger strike, and with the consequences that you're speaking about, and with also the possibility of really reaching out and changing things dramatically in terms of reaching out to the society at large and the rest of this. So one, their first one is end group punishment. What is meant there?
Yeah. Well, the CDC does have a practice very commonly of locking down a whole group, usually a racial or ethnic group, when one prisoner or a couple of prisoners violate a rule. So there's an assault by members of one ethnic group on a guard. What happens if they lock down all the prisoners of that ethnic group? Well, you know, anyone on the street will say, that's ridiculous. That's not fair. You can't do that. But the prison authorities do it all the time and have been getting away with it. So that is the first demand of the prisoners. Hold individuals accountable for their behavior. That's a very simple principle that I don't think anyone will disagree with, except the prison authorities.
What about this thing about abolishing debriefing? What is debriefing, and what's the significance of that demand?
Debriefing, I think, has become the overwhelming reality of life in the SHU, and that's how the prisoners are seeing it. It is basically snitching and confessing. The staff says, give us information about all your gang activities, everything you know about the gang, and name names of other gang members and tell us what they've done, and then we'll let you out of the SHU and put you in a unit with much better conditions. Well, there's several problems with that. First of all, prisoners have a very strong code against snitching, like most of us outside. We don't like the idea of tattling on other people. And in some cases, of course, if people are in gangs, the bonds between them and the fellow gang members are very tight, and they believe their survival in prison has depended on allying with other men to protect each other. The other problem is that so many, perhaps the majority, of the men who are in their so-called gang validated as either members or associates of the gangs have nothing to do with gangs. Or at least on the basis of the so-called evidence, there's no reason for anyone to conclude that they did. The evidence is as ridiculous as you can imagine. Someone will have a photo that's 20 years old. It was taken with the guy they happened to be roomed with when they first came into the prison before they were assigned to a particular prison. Someone snapped a photo of them. The gang investigators now find it and say, oh, well, 5 years after that, we validated we're associating with the gang members.
We seem to have temporarily lost our connection with Marilyn. Not sure what happened there. But meanwhile, let me remind you that we're talking with Marilyn McMahon, who is the executive director of the and treasurer of the California Prison Focus on the hunger strike called by prisoners at Pelican Bay. The hunger strike began July 1st. And it includes five core demands, and we're talking with Marilyn about these demands: end group punishment, abolish debriefing and modify active-inactive gang status criteria, comply with recommendations from a 2006 U.S. commission to make segregation a last resort and end conditions of isolation, provide adequate food, prisoners reporting unsanitary conditions and small quantities of food. They want adequate food, including nutritional meals. And the fifth one is expand and provide constructive programs and privileges for indefinite SHU inmates, including the opportunity to engage in self-help treatment, education, religious, and other productive activities, which are routinely denied. The demands include one phone call per week. Imagine that, demanding that the right to have one phone call a week, or how about one photo per year, two packages a year, and more visiting time, permission to have wall calendars and sweatsuits and watch caps, since warm clothing is often denied, even though the cells and the exercise cage itself can be bitterly cold. And I wanted to let people know that, you know, this is an incredibly important thing, that this is an incredibly important thing going on right now. It's something that really strikes at one of the major contradictions in this society right now. It strikes at one of the major things that's going on. And I'm, you know, it would be really important for people to recognize this. This is prisoners in the Pelican Bay State Prison Security Housing Unit D facility corridor have begun an indefinite strike. They began it on July 1st, 2011, in order to draw attention to and to peacefully protest 25 years of torture via the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation's arbitrary, illegal, and progressively more punitive policies and practices. Now, remember, this is coming in the wake of the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court about the cruel and unusual punishment in California prisons. All right, we have Marilyn back on the line. Marilyn, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this again.
I'm sorry. Could I jump back and
sure.
finish the thought about the debriefing?
Sure, absolutely.
I got cut off. But the main point, in short, is that so many of these men are in the SHU, so-called gang validated, but there's been nothing that a reasonable person would call actual evidence that they're in a gang. All kinds of specious things are used. And it's not clear necessarily what the motivations are, but they're not put in there because they're associating with gangs. They're put in there for some other reason, and the staff finds something that it can call evidence. So in terms of the debriefing, that puts them in a position of having to tell everything they know about the gang in order not to spend the rest of their lives in the SHU. Well, they're not in a gang. What do they know about it? What information can they give? They can't give true information. But if they break psychologically and they can't stand it anymore, or they can't stand what their family is going through because they're in there, then they make up something, they name somebody, and they give a list of names to the investigators, and now the investigators have a nice new list. They go out and find all those guys, and that's one piece of evidence against them, and you have this endless cycle filling up the SHU.
One last question, because we're running out of time now, unbelievably. I kept thinking we'd have more and more time, but let's talk about, we can talk about this thing of, you know, I had mentioned to you earlier when we talked earlier about this term that's used by a lot of prisoners of civil death, and I kept thinking about what that meant, and they were talking about ending up in the SHU is actually getting a civil death sentence. And I thought of that in relation to even this fifth demand, where very basic elements of humanity are taken from people, and they're demanding. It reminds me of Attica when they stood up and said, we're human beings and we demand to be treated as such. Can you talk about this a little?
Sure. It's true that the authorities have found this amazing way to cause someone maybe more pain than just killing them, to put them in sensory deprivation and social isolation for decades and decades, and tamper with everything that they still have. You know, routinely play with their mail, reject letters from the few people who actually do write to them for some violation of a rule they just made up, cut down their food rations, not put any spices, whatever, in the food, water it down, et cetera, et cetera. Every little thing every day is chipped away at or taken away from them, and it's just continuing psychological torture. And many tactics are used to cut off ties with family and friends that have managed to stick with them, so the isolation just increases over time. So it is a death, certainly in a way. It's, you know, if we were all to think, what makes life for us? You know, what is life really about? Everything that we experience that we enjoy, that makes it worth living, has been taken from them.
Mm-hmm.
So they are physically alive, just barely. And I think that's what he means by civil death, or that's a part of it.
Okay. Now, Marilyn, how can people find out more information about the strike? It began on July 1st, but it's going to continue. And how can people find out information about it?
Okay. They should go to the blog of the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. It has a very long name. I'll give it to you, and then I'll give you a simpler one.
Okay.
The blog is Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity, all one word, .wordpress.com.
So Prisoner Hunger Strikes, let me read that again. Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity .wordpress.com?
Yes. And if people don't have pen and paper, then here's something simpler to remember, which is www.prisons.org. That's the website of California Prison Focus, and from there you'll find the link to the blog as well as other information.
Okay, Marilyn, and we'll have you back to keep updates on the strike as it progresses.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I've just been talking with Marilyn McMahon, who's the executive director of California Prison Focus, and we're talking about the launching of the hunger strike by the Pelican Bay SHU inmates. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Clyde Young. All right, welcome back. And that is Archie Shepp with Blues for Brother George Jackson from Attica Blues. All right, from that album. Joining us now is Clyde Young, a revolutionary communist and former prisoner himself, who's going to talk with us about his experiences and about the hunger strike and why it's important that people support it. Clyde, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here, Michael.
Well, you know, let's jump into this. One of the things that I found, and I didn't get a chance to ask my previous guests about it, but I thought you might be able to speak to it, one, with more experience, but also with a big, with a sort of a bigger outlook on it, in the sense of what is the significance of the fact that this strike has been called, as the prisoners themselves have made a big point of noting, it's been called by a lot of people of different nationalities, different races. What's the significance of that?
That's extremely important because a lot of times in prison, there are divisions among different races and different nationalities. And the important thing to point out also is that the guards often, you know, do things to exploit and promote those divisions, to get people fighting against one another and diverting their attention really from the real problem, which is the system, the prison system itself and the larger system. So this is extremely important that people have come together across racial lines to, you know, call this strike, and that people of different nationalities are going to be participating in it. I can't tell you how important that is just from my own experience of being in prison. And I have been in certain situations in prison rebellions where it was extremely important that, for instance, I was in one struggle one time, and I learned a tremendous amount from this, and there was it was a struggle over prison conditions and also had a political component because some of the people who had been active in prison, a couple of them were even Panthers at the time, who came into that prison were put in solitary. So we were protesting both the conditions but also the fact that these prisoners had been put in the solitary. And we gathered on a recreation yard, and it was mainly blacks but a few whites and others. And the guards opened fire on us. Now, the point is, and killing two people and wounding 45, and the point is not to say, well, if you have other people involved, then you can prevent that kind of thing. That's not my point. My point is that it's very important for prisoners as a whole to come together and oppose the conditions that are being imposed on all of them.
When you talk about the conditions in prison, you know, one of the things that I've come to learn a lot more deeply over the past period of time is the difference that these supermax prisons have made in the conditions of prisoners. And we were talking yesterday, and you had mentioned that the conditions you faced were pretty horrendous, but you thought that the conditions today were even worse. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, I can. You know, when I was in prison, it was hell. I'm not going to sit here and tell you. Anytime that you're locked up, you're deprived of your freedom, the monotony of prison, you know, and then the brutality. I just talked about a very brutal situation in which two prisoners were killed and 45 were wounded. And you would think that was a statistics from Vietnam at that time, but this was inside a prison, people protesting, and at that time protesting peacefully. So, I think that, these conditions are such that people are driven because look, we felt in that situation that we were prepared to die. And what I'm getting from the prisoners at Pelican Bay is that they're prepared to do the same thing just because of it was just very difficult to bear listening to your two previous speakers, particularly Laura, who was talking about the kind of conditions people are being subjected to, that they're, you know, look, in the prison, the game is to break you down. And when I was in prison, frankly, it was hell, but now it's much worse. And in fact, we heard when we were in prison back in the late 60s about Marion. Marion was being built, Marion Federal Penitentiary in Illinois.
That was the first supermax
prison. That was the first one. And we heard about it, and we were just, you know, horrified that basically what they were going to be doing is having special units for behavior modification where prisoners were even more systematically going to be broken down. That was a horror. Now the horror has become the reality. I mean, there's tens of thousands of prisoners. I understand that Laura has given the statistic of 100,000 prisoners are incarcerated in these type of conditions in long-term isolation, which breaks the mind down and is nothing less than torture by international standards.
Quick reminder, we're talking with Clyde Young, a revolutionary communist and a former prisoner, and we're talking about the hunger strike by the inmates confined to the Pelican Bay SHU, the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, a veritable torture chamber. You know, one thing that's also, it strikes me, there's a question here of when you're talking about the conditions. You know, one thing is that these supermax prisons have never been done any other time in history. There has never been any society that has had this kind of supermax prison, this kind of long-term isolation. I mean, I was reading about Hugo Pinnell this morning. Mm-hmm. You know, how long has that brother been in isolation? He's been in the SHU unit at Pelican Bay since it was began, and even before that, he was held in long-term isolation.
And segregation,
This is exactly that kind of psychological torture. Now, I wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things we also know is that there is a huge element, a huge connection between this, and it would seem, and the mass incarceration that has developed, particularly for black and brown people. The fact that we have 2.3 million people in prison, and what, more than 60% or 60% of them or so are black or brown? This is an outrage. And what do you see as the connection between the conditions in these SHU units and this mass incarceration?
Well, that's a very important question. And I think it's important to also emphasize that the rulers of this country have gone to great lengths to bamboozle people, to trick people into believing that somehow, basically, they're animals that are incarcerated in these places. But the reality is that people basically look. I went to prison. I served 8 years in prison, and I went in there for armed robbery, and I came out a revolutionary communist. I transformed in prison, and there's tremendous ability for people to transform. But look, let's look at the situation from the 1960s. People just like the ones who are incarcerated in the SHUs today were the people, not exactly the same people, but I'm saying the younger generation essentially coming from the same station in life in the 1960s contributed a tremendous amount to rocking this system to its very foundations. And what the rulers are saying is that's never going to happen again. So there's a certain preemptive character to what they're doing by incarcerating on a massive scale. I mean, look, there's nowhere else in the world where this number of prisoners are incarcerated, 2.3 million, and the overwhelming majority of them are black and Latino. You tell me that's not a conscious policy on the part of the rulers. It's definitely a conscious policy to try to preempt anything approaching what happened in the 1960s.
Now, let me ask you, I think we have time for one more question, and I wanted to ask you this because I think it's extremely important. From your own experience, as well as looking more broadly, stepping back and where you're at now, what's the importance of people supporting the Pelican Bay prisoners in their hunger strike?
It's extremely important for all the reasons that the previous speakers talked about and some of the things I'm attempting to say. These prisoners must not be allowed to just stand alone. In other words, the conditions that they're confronting are unacceptable. It's unacceptable for human beings to be incarcerated in this type of way, and it's unacceptable for those of us who recognize this not to step forward and support them. This is absolutely unacceptable what they're doing, and we should stand firmly with the people all over California and beyond should stand firmly with these prisoners and their demands.
Which again reminds me of this statement by this prisoner who has tremendous faith in the ability of people and the desire of people to stand to, he thinks that the prison officials in the state has underestimated the decency, principles, and humanity of the people. He has a lot of faith, and people need to actually make that faith.
That's
real.
A profound message,
yeah.
Actually.
Let me read this, a very profound message, and we'll wrap up with this. An appeal to those the system has cast off. Here I am speaking not only to prisoners, but to those whose life is lived on the desperate edge, whether or not they find some work or even homes. To all those this system and its enforcers treat as so much human waste material, raise your sights above the degradation and madness, the muck and demoralization, above the individual battle to survive and be somebody on the terms of the imperialists, of fouler, more monstrous criminals than mythology has ever invented or jails ever held. Become a part of the human saviors of humanity, the grave diggers of this system and the bearers of the future communist society. This is not just talk or an attempt to make poetry here. There are great tasks to be fulfilled, great struggles to be carried out, and yes, great sacrifices to be made to accomplish all this. But there is a world to save and to win. And in that process, those who the system has counted as nothing can count for a great deal. They represent a great reserve force that must become an active force for proletarian revolution.
And that was from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his new book, Basics. You can't change the world without knowing the basics.
You've got about a half a minute if you want to comment on
that. Well, what I can tell you right there, that's what's concentrated in that particular statement, is a vision of a whole new world, and that these prisoners can play a role in that. Not just them, but people coming from all different stations in life can play a tremendous role in transforming this system. And I think what you see in Pelican Bay and what you see in prisons all over this country is one more reason why this system needs to be done away with.
All right, Clyde, thank you very much for joining us today. And I want to let people know there's a special issue of Revolution Newspaper. It's issue number 183, and it's on prisons and prisoners in the U.S., from the hellholes of incarceration to a future of emancipation. You can go to revcom.us, check that out, and learn a whole hell of a lot. All right. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson. I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And remember, if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Still Alive from Social Distortion, a great message at the end of this program.
Still alive, and I will survive.